two, one, two, three, four.
I love this new era where people are saying, yes, I am going to create a chief AI officer position because we know that this is something that is going to significantly affect our future and it can't be a side job for someone. The only thing I'm actually surprised about is how often they give it to someone who's not a radiologist. But like, that seems crazy to me because in radiology, we have the most experience. We've been doing this since 2016, the old fashioned CAD we've been doing for years and years. We're a very technical field and we know probably more about it than many, many specialties. We also touch a lot of different specialties. So it just seemed very obvious to me that multiple groups looking for a chief AI officer would go to someone in radiology. And maybe it's people in radiology aren't raising their hands. Maybe they're not choosing that, but it seems like a very perfect position for a radiologist. And it's one of the things that I love about our career is that you can evolve to doing all kinds of different things. And I think there'll be a whole new arm of radiology in the future that is a AI related position, overseeing AI. How do we have human AI interactions to make sure we're mitigating bias? That could be a whole new role, a new position in radiology.
Well, welcome to the podcast of the American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine. And today it's my pleasure to be interviewing Dr. Nina Kotler. Nina is the Associate Chief Medical Officer for Clinical Artificial Intelligence at Radiology Partners. And for those of you who don't know, Radiology Partners is the largest practice of radiologists, for sure, in the nation. Is it worldwide, perhaps? I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know that I've ever checked, but I think it probably is.
And Nina is actually the very first physician to be in the practice. And I know that it's well over 3,000 radiologists and counting, growing exponentially. But Nina is, in addition to leading this AI effort at Radiology Partners, also recently has some affiliation that she'll tell us about with the Center for Artificial Intelligence and Medicine and Imaging at Stanford. I'm just going to read a very concise bio before we start our interview. But this is Dr. Nina Kotler, a practicing radiologist for over 15 years with clinical experience combined with a graduate degree, and this is important, in applied mathematics, and we're going to talk about that, and optimization theory. She has been using technology innovation to improve quality and drive value in radiology. She's the first radiologist to join Radiology Partners. She's held multiple leadership positions within that practice. Currently, she's the Associate Chief Medical Officer for Clinical AI, serves on innovation steering committees, working groups, leads the data science and analytics division of the clinical value team, is VP of clinical operations, and has developed and practices in Radiology Partners' remote imaging division, serving internally in their AI, IT, and culture and leadership support boards, and runs education and development for Radiology Partners. And externally, she serves on many important committees, which I really admire that from a leadership point of view, which is ACR Metrics Committee, ACR Quality and Safety Conference and Planning, SIM Machine Learning Committee, SIM Program Committee, Scientific Abstract Reviewer, RSNA Educational Exhibits Committee. And very notably in 2018, received the Trailblazer Award in recognition of a pioneering female leader in the field of imaging informatics. So all I could say is, wow. And not only myself, but in general, you're viewed as the rock star of artificial intelligence in medicine. And I'm so delighted that you are willing to be interviewed today, given your busy schedule, and that you're willing to be the keynote speaker for our conference. But let's go into the story of how you got involved with artificial intelligence and medicine. And I think for all of us in the field, it's the word is serendipity, but I'd like to hear your version of serendipity.
Well, I'll comment first that when I hear you give that introduction, I realize how quickly time passes because I'm now almost 20 years of practicing radiology. That was 15. So it's really crazy. It just catches up with you and you don't even realize it. And that is kind of how I got involved in AI. I mean, I do have a background in applied mathematics, and you'd think, oh, okay, great. If you combine mathematics, which AI is essentially matrix multiplications and mathematical statistics. If you combine that with clinical, you really make clinical AI. I was kind of maybe destined for it, but that's not how life works. I knew nothing about artificial intelligence, and in fact, the first physician that one of the physicians that was a founder at Radiology Partners, his name is Anthony Gabriel. And he is super smart guy. We were talking to each other in 2016, and at that point, I was a VP of clinical operations, doing all kinds of other things in our startup. And he said, "Nina," we were with a few other people as well, but he's like, "Do any of you know what this new AI is?" Because we all knew the old-fashioned CAD, the CAD that was very programmatic, and you told it what a lesion in the breast that was malignant might look like. And so it was very deterministic and not very good. And he said, "Do you guys know the difference between that old-fashioned CAD and the new AI, which at the time was machine learning, deep learning?" And everyone kind of looked at each other and we're all like, "No." And I said, "No." And he's like, "Well, I do." And I'm like, "Game on, mister. Now we're going to learn something about this AI stuff." I'm a very competitive person. I grew up with a brother and he was always better at me than everything. So anyway, that's kind of how I started. But the underlying story to that is at the time I was part of a team called the Clinical Value Team. And that team was designed very specifically to figure out how do we drive value in radiology? Because at the time, most of the metrics in radiology, I would argue even many of them today, are not actually quality and value metrics. They're not necessarily improving the lives or doing things for the quadruple aim. They were more operational metrics like turnaround times. And that is important and that has downstream effects. But looking only at number of peer review cases done and turnaround times as being your only evaluations of quality, we just didn't think was good enough. We wanted something that was measurable, that represented true quality. And so we came up with these things that we called best practice recommendations. And these are things that are coming out of evidence-based medicine, population health journal articles that said, if you have a certain pathology, here's what the follow-up should be. So we took those, we went through them with our internal divisions of subspecialties, and we expanded upon them. And then we used change management to pass them out to our radiologists and said, all right, let's start with a few simple things like thyroid nodules and ovarian cysts, and tell you for those people who are not doing the proper follow-up based on these journal articles, how can we get you to do it? So we educated people about it and used a whole change management process. As we did that, we realize that once you do a few of them, it's very hard for a human to remember all of that. Like humans are very, just not that good at initiating a workflow. And that's what we're requiring people to do. In fact, in healthcare overall, we ask the clinician to be the one that's the integrating agent, the one that's initiating a workflow. It's terrible. It's a much better process for AI. So I looked for something that was an AI solution that could help the radiologist in a clinical decision support mechanism tell them, hey, you know, this is something that requires a best practice. We have one on it. And by the way, here's what the best practice is. There wasn't anything out there. So I engaged a group of external data scientists and we created one together. And that was our first AI product that we ever created. It was called RecOMD for recommending for physicians. And it would help recommend these best practices so we as humans didn't have to remember. And that's now expanded. We've rolled it out across much of the practice. But that was my very first sort of foray into AI. And since I had been guided by Anthony to try to learn it, I was super interested in it. It was fascinating to me and just a whole new area to learn about. And I learned about it through experience. So you don't need to be a mathematician. You don't need to have massive amounts of training in this. I think one of the best ways to learn about AI is through experience.
I love that statement. And I really, for our listeners, there's so many pearls that I think you're going to offer to the younger generation that's, you know, coming out of training right now. And I think this is really key, that it's all about education and being open to learning new things. And you kind of explored an area that was unknown, and over time you are now literally the master of it for the world. And so that's why we have you here today. Just along those lines, I want this to go a little back and forth just so the audience can see the pathway. Because there are not any formal training programs in AI and medicine quite yet, there are some master's programs coming out this year that are part of medical schools that we're collaborating on, but there up until now, prior to this year, there isn't a formal path. They're starting to become a formal path. So all of us that are doing this kind of work have kind of stumbled into it the way you did, almost out of necessity to take care of a patient. But I love that you went all in, deep dive, and used your passion and your skills for problem solving and implementation to like be a difference maker for patient care. But I wanted to say a couple things about the mathematics, because I think that's important. And I just a little side note is that the way I got involved, similar to you, is that I went to medical school with a guy named Bill Gallanter, and he was in the MD-PhD program. And we barely intersected throughout medical school on a few rotations. But then we reconnected again when I became a faculty member at the University of Illinois Division of Academic Internal Medicine. And in my first week, I went up to Bill because we were in clinic together supervising residents. And Bill said, and I said, Bill, I want to do some research with you, publish. And he said, Mel, at heart, I'm a mathematician. I view myself as a mathematician first. And I said, I didn't really know that. He said, yeah, I did the MD, PhD. And he said, I'm working on this really cool project. And people come to me with their projects because I can do the mathematical analysis really well. And he said, we're about to publish a paper on diagnosing diabetes from a chest x-ray in JAMA. And this was like so cool for me. And that was kind of the introduction. And then shortly after that, our research day and our academic day, the keynote speaker was Judy Gachoya. So I got to talk with her more, and the next thing you know, I got pulled in at your level into all of this, and I just never stopped, and it's been an amazing ride. And I realized, like you did, that to really, because this is happening so fast, and this approach of using AI as a tool to help patients is like truly where the difference making is going to be in medicine, I just stepped down from my dream job to start this organization to have a professional home for physicians to educate them on AI and medicine. And the main reason is there's not enough time, as we talked about before we started this podcast. There's not enough time in a day to do all these things and see 25, 30 patients a day or do 8 hours of reading a day. It's just humanly impossible. So we need leaders like yourself who like really devote the bulk of their time to solving these problems. So thank you for doing that. Something that's emerged in this regard is that most major medical centers now, in the last 12 months, have appointed someone like you or myself to be a chief AI officer, to literally spend all of their time or almost all of their time doing what we do. I'd like to hear your thoughts on how you do that at Radiology Partners, but also you have a really good pulse of what's going on worldwide. And I like your thoughts on how that role is being established and implemented for at some of the really big university hospitals and what your vision is of that.
Yeah, Mel, I think the point that you made is exactly on point for answering this question, and I'm going to use it as the answer. You said that you had a dream job, but you had to give it up in order to spend time really dedicating yourself to doing AI and being able to train other people so that they can learn about it, right? Like, that's the key. It's the reason why I'm successful. There's nothing extra special about me. I was given the time by my two co-founders, Rich and Anthony, to say, Nina, you just spend your time thinking about AI. And I'm not going to pay you to read cases. I do. I still read cases, but I am paid to think about AI. And it can't be a side job. That's always what it's been in the past. We ask radiologists to do their full-time job, but then on the side, do something else that's really a half-time job or could become a full-time job. And it's very, very difficult to do that, especially these days where we need more and more people reading. You just get pulled back into clinical and it's very hard to do the AI component. So you have to be given dedicated time. And I love this new era where people are saying, yes, I am going to create a chief AI officer position because we know that this is something that is going to significantly affect our future and it can't be a side job for someone. The only thing I'm actually surprised about is how often they give it to someone who's not a radiologist. They're like, that seems crazy to me because in radiology, we have the most experience. We've been doing this since 2016, the old-fashioned CAD we've been doing for years and years. We're a very technical field, and we know probably more about it than many, many specialties. We also touch a lot of different specialties. So it just seemed very obvious to me that multiple groups looking for a chief AI officer would go to someone in radiology. And maybe it's people in radiology aren't raising their hands. Maybe they're not choosing that, but it seems like a very perfect position for a radiologist. And it's one of the things that I love about our career is that you can evolve to doing all kinds of different things. And I think there'll be a whole new arm of radiology in the future that is an AI-related position, overseeing AI. How do we have human AI interactions to make sure we're mitigating bias? That could be a whole new role, a new position in radiology.
Absolutely. I have to tell you that I attended a really great session at our SNA, and it was I wasn't expecting it. It was about mid-career transitions. And actually, this is something that's really a buzz nationwide for people like you and I who are in academics. There's this, I was amazed. It were four radiologists who are really well known. I mean, these are like equal, some really great people. And they all told their story about how they were no longer finding joy in their career, even though they're at the most famous institutions. And they kind of gave their story, almost like what you and I are telling our story of how they pivoted their career in a way to really find meaning and purpose and to fulfill their passion and the things that they were really interested in. And almost to the point where, we don't, I'm going to speak for you and myself, even though I shouldn't do that. We don't view medicine as a job or even this AI as work. It's like we do it in our free time because it's fun. We enjoy it. It's exciting. It's really a passion, not a job. And I think that's the kind of motivation we need for people who are leaders in this field. But I do want to pivot into this whole topic about the radiologists, and the reason I want to do that is Our conference really wants to focus on the over 1,000 FDA algorithms that are available for use to care for patients. And as you know, 75% of them are in radiology. So I do agree that the radiologists are the ones that need to be taking the lead in all of this. You have found a way at Radiology Partners to do implementation of AI where everyone else is struggling with this all across the nation. This is, something where this year at RSNA, all of the industry vendors were there, demos were being done, but leaders in healthcare are trying to figure out how to actually implement this in 2025 in the real world, where you've already done it now for quite some time at Radiology Partners. So let's talk a bit about what are some of the secrets to success that you've had in implementing AI algorithms at Radiology Partners?
Well, I think we started pretty early, and as an early adopter of AI, you have to invest in it. Now we're at different stages. One of the things that I like to use to guide how I think about AI or really any new technology is Gartner's hype cycle. And if you all haven't seen that, it's just look it up. It's really helpful because history repeats itself. And every time we implement a new technology, whether that was PACS or MR or CT, we kind of go through this same hype cycle and it helps us understand what our future is going to look like and not get overwhelmed by it in the hype cycle or depressed by it in the trough of disillusionment. We understand where we're going. And we as humans, we like certainty. It gives you a little bit of certainty. And so in the beginning, when I was implementing AI at Radiology Partners in our practice, it was pretty early on and it was like right top of the curve hype cycle. We had Jeff Hinton saying radiologists are going to be replaced and we don't need them anymore, and then doubling down on that, and other people saying, well, what's going to happen to my job? It was like really scary. Back then, things are so early and immature, and everyone is overhyping it. You might think it's like amazing, but if you're going to deploy it, you have to like spend a lot of extra time working on it, and you realize it doesn't work as well as people say. So you have to invest in it. I think we're a lot further down that curve now. We've come probably out of the trough of disillusionment, at least for the current AI that has been FDA cleared or approved. And for that, I'm talking about convolutional neural networks for imaging, natural language processing. Those things are more well-defined. So for someone to get involved, it's a lot easier. You do have to decide you're investing in it because while there is a small return on investment, it depends on who you are. And no one is paying for it right now. So CMS has not said, I'm going to give a category one CPT code for everything. They've given a few small things like the NTAP payment. There's maybe one category one CPT code for one small area of AI. There's some category three, but none of it is global. So if you're going to figure out how to implement it, since no one is going to pay you for it, you have to think about what the return on investment is for you. So that's one part. The other part, and what gets us to that plateau of productivity, as it's called the Gartner hype cycle, where the vast majority of people are using it, it requires best practices. Meaning, and this is Mel, is why I would hope that you would have an organization like you're creating. We need to be sharing how we're doing things. We can't all recreate the wheel. It will take far too long to get things deployed. And we have a call to action right now in healthcare where we really need to change how we're practicing medicine. AI gives us that opportunity. But if you don't know as much about AI as someone like Mel or myself, how are you going to implement it? Well, you learn about it from people who have more expertise. I mean, that's what I even do that today. I spend time every month and I speak to another expert in AI. It's fascinating. You learn a lot and you don't have to learn it all through that extensive time that it takes for experience at every single component of it. So now I think that's what I would recommend is you've got to figure out your ROI. learn about it so you feel comfortable implementing it, and take some best practices that are out there now being created by lots of different organizations and shared among multiple organizations, whether that's in conferences or some in journal articles. So you just have a foot in the door in understanding how to get going.
Great. Well, thank you. So academic medicine physicians have recognized that we're in a dilemma here. For medications that are FDA approved, they've been studied in randomized trials. We see them in New England Journal and JAMA. But for these AI devices, we don't quite have that huge body of evidence yet. And so the universities have joined one of two or three organizations. One is called CHAI, another is called TRAIN. I know that for both of those, over 50 university hospitals have joined with the notion of sharing their data and experiences to develop those kind of best practices that you talked about. How do you see us closing the gap between using things for patient care that haven't really been rigorously tested in the traditional evidence-based medicine way?
It's an interesting question because normally in healthcare, we're like 20 years behind from a technology standpoint as everyone else. And we can move slowly. It may seem fast, but in many ways, we move very slowly with new ideas. We research them, we print them in journal articles, and then try to get as many people to read those as possible. Now we're in an area where we're tip of the spear in technology. We're looking at something that continues to evolve, not once a year, but like once a day, once a week. Everything is moving really, really quickly. In fact, like by the time you would write a book about AI, it's probably way out of date. And so I think we have to think about how do we evolve our learning in a way that keeps up with it. If we want to stay at the tip of the spear of technology, deploy things like now foundation models, which are transformer architecture, or some new architecture that's already starting to come out, or even agentic AI in our workflows, these things that are going to solve our problems. If we want to stay tip of the spear of those, it's very hard to wait for the process of academic medicine to get that all through. It's just evolving very quickly. That being said, we can't just go out there and test things on patients. Like, that's not right either. So, how do you find some in between where we are learning evidence-based medicine, but it's more a much more efficient way of doing that? And I think some of that is coming out now. It comes out in discussions like this, it comes out in conferences where people are presenting their work. They might not have printed it yet in journal articles. You get an early preview of what's going on. I use social media a lot. Now you have to follow the right people. You never know exactly what in social media might be truth and not truth. So you have to follow people who are really respectful and that are doing good work in this area. But I think that the evidence that we are going to use is initially going to come from people on the ground who are using these tools and talking about them, eventually publishing them, as opposed to traditional academic medical centers where they're doing all the work. If you think about it, a lot of radiologists are using AI today. If we could all publish or talk about our experience, we would raise the bar much more quickly than waiting for things to come out in journal articles. And I think that's partially how it's going to evolve. The other way I think it's going to evolve is something that the FDA started talking about, which I'm really, really happy about. Now, regulatory clearance, as you're suggesting, I mean, most of these, if they're going to be sold, anything that relates to computer vision has to go through regulatory clearance in the FDA. And the FDA is supposed to be doing this for us. They're supposed to be making sure these tools are safe. But in theory, that is true. But in practice, it's not reality. In practice, when you deploy it on your data, your patient population, your exam population, there's so much variability that these models may not be sufficiently generalizable to use only the data from the FDA. So regulatory clearance does not equate to clinical validation for widespread adoption. And so what we're seeing happening, which is a very good thing, is independent groups that are looking to evaluate AI tools are validating them on their patient population and their exam population. If we could then get all of those groups who are all independently validating these AI tools to present that, make that available publicly, then all of a sudden you get this massive amount of information that is going to be far more quick than waiting for a very big study to be performed. It's kind of like, ground up level intelligence. Let's do it that way. The other thing that I mentioned the FDA is moving toward is something called the total product life cycle for AI. Right now, they're mostly validating something a priori before it goes live. But what we found when we deploy a tool is that our testing that we do before we go live is not exactly the same results that you get when you implement it. And that's because implementation is complicated and it's a different environment than the environment that you use in a lab. So being able to having methods to and being able to evaluate the quality of your AI tool over time, what we call continuous monitoring, is super important. And I think we all need to move toward that end so that when we deploy AI, we are continuously learning about it. We're not reliant fully on what happens up front, then that's a second mechanism that I think is really going to help us move forward as quickly or close to the pace at which this technology is evolving. And we need both of them.
Wow, that was wonderful. Thank you for giving that insight. I really feel like we are like boldly going into an area where no human being has ever gone. You and I and the rest of us are doing it together, but it's really challenging but exciting. And to use your problem-solving skills, those things you learned in mathematics or about breaking down a problem into its component part, those core skills we learn when we're in like undergrad are fantastic now as we're facing these like problems that have never been pro solved before in ways that the world has never seen. So definitely exciting times, a lot of enthusiasm for all this. The buzz at our SNA this year, as you know, was all AI. It was so cool. And although I didn't attend the one in Europe right now, the similar buzz for the European Radiology Society on all things AI and to incredible enthusiasm amongst radiologists and all physicians for using this tool. So we're going to end with Nina's string of pearls. Give us like five or six pearls that we could take away that you would want to give advice to anyone who is high level doing AI and radiology work, like things that they never would find in writing, but pearls that you want to share with our audience.
Well, a lot of the things that we've done, we haven't actually published yet. So many of them are not in writing. We do like to present them because we want to share our knowledge so other people can build from that base. But ironically, we partnered with Stanford and David Larson and his AI development and education group. And they're soon going to be publishing a bunch of these pearls that you're talking about and how you validate an AI model before you go live. We've got a five-step process that he's made even more robust. We have some discussions about bias. So let me give you a couple of insights into that or hints about what's going to come out. So bias is something that people, I don't think, are thinking enough about. Everyone speaks about it, but the solutions that I'm hearing about how you mitigate bias is just creating a nutrition label for the AI model. We all know that every AI model is internally biased by the data it was trained on. So knowing the data is trained on is quite useful because then you understand the bias. I want you all to think about bias in a larger framework. There is no AI in radiology right now in the US that is autonomous. And that means the AI results are being not presented on their own. they're being presented with the radiologist as an adjunct. So what you're getting is a radiologist plus AI. You have to mitigate the bias that happens at the point of care. And that is something that unless we solve this and think about how to do this well, it's going to be very hard to deploy AI at scale because we'll start seeing things like automation bias and complacency. Someone asked me about it last week at the Stanford Radiology Improvement Summit, and they said, "Listen, we're starting to see automation bias. How do we fix that?" And I'll give you a couple of pearls just around that of what we think and what we've seen is helpful. Number one, education. Educate your radiologists not only about the specific AI that you're using and where it works well, where it doesn't work well, but also about AI in general. A lot of people don't recognize that disease prevalence has such a great or pronounced effect on how we perceive the AI tool. Diseases that are uncommon have far more false positives, and there's nothing you can do about that. It's a mathematical equation. So the way we perceive things has that significant effect. We also need to help mitigate AI bias or human AI bias by doing things like making the AI more transparent. Think about what information would you want from your AI system so that you could make a more informed decision. Some people are saying, well, let's hold off giving the AI result until after the radiologist reads the study. That's one mechanism. Other mechanisms are providing more explainability into the black box about how the AI is thinking, providing its confidence. You're getting right now a binary yes, no. If the confidence is 99% or 49%, as long as it's above the threshold, you get a yes answer. Wouldn't it be helpful to know it's very high confidence versus not so high confidence? How about data orchestration? You don't even necessarily know what data the AI is looking at. So there are a ton of things that I think we should be requiring of our vendors to provide to us to mitigate bias at the point of care. I think we have a long way to go, and I'm super excited that that I'm looking at that area quite hard. And I think that will be really important as we start to deploy more and more AI.
Well, great. Well, just a shout out to the Stanford program in general. I did attend the Stanford annual AI conference this year, which was phenomenal. I also am actively enrolled in through Coursera in the Stanford Artificial Intelligence and Medicine Certificate Program, taught by some amazing radiologists from Stanford. And for our audience, if you like what you heard today and you are interested in more, come and listen to Nina give the keynote address at our national meeting, which is Saturday, September 20th. She'll be speaking at McCormick Place, Chicago. And the theme of our conference is the evidence-based medicine application of artificial intelligence in medicine to take care of patients. And excited that Nina will be our keynote speaker. Nina, it has been such a pleasure speaking with you today, and having a conversation with you is always very exciting. And thanks for all the wonderful things you do in leadership for the AI and medicine space. And looking forward to intersecting with you throughout the year at various educational activities. So thanks for being here today.
Of course. Thanks, Mel, for chatting with me, and thanks everyone for listening.
If you enjoyed what you heard here today, consider becoming a member of our professional society by going to www.americancollegeaim.org and click join. Also, don't forget to save the dates. September 19th and 20th, 2025, we'll be having our first ever scientific session at McCormick Place right here in Chicago. Go to our website to register to attend the conference. We hope to see you all live in Chicago, and we look forward to having you tune in to our next podcast on Melvin Monday here on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.